Welcome to this episode of the Reverse Alzheimer's Summit. I'm so excited to introduce you to Dr. Lane Freeman and Dr. Stuart Nunnally. They are just an essential part of this conversation around Alzheimer's, and you're going to learn why quickly. Dr. Freeman returned to her childhood dental practice in 2002 as a dentist, where she helped develop it into a leading center for integrative biological dental care. And Dr. Stuart Nunnally is a board certified in naturopathic medicine, as well as integrative biological dental medicine. So you can see why I think it's just absolutely critical. You've heard me talk about how important dental health and oral health is to the brain, how they're so directly connected, not only anatomically, but throughout the whole system, throughout the circulatory system, and in so, so, so many ways that we're going to dive into deeply right now. Dr. Freeman, Dr. Nunnally, welcome.
Thank you so much. We're so excited to be here with you today and to discuss this very important component, your oral health, that how that affects care for Alzheimer's patients, but also just anyone with any systemic issues.
So there are so many directions. I feel like we could go so fast and we could talk for days about this. But first, I just want everyone to know about your amazing story about you, Dr. Freeman, returning to Dr. Nunnally's practice and then how that got you into this biological dentistry. So tell the story, please.
Well, I'm going to take the first part of it.
Go ahead.
So it's hard to believe, but 22 years ago, at just about this time of year, I was beginning to have some bizarre fasciculations, which are twitches that you can see, of course. And we all see these from time to time around our eye. Various muscles will fasciculate, but these became very concerning for me. And finally, after seeing a neurologist for months, I was referred to the ALS Center in Houston, thinking that I had ALS. As it turned out, I did not, but I went to Montreal for treatment at that point, thinking that I did have ALS. And literally the day I walked out of my practice to be gone and not set foot in this practice again for 6 weeks, Lane Freeman walked in as a baby dentist, and she took over a thriving practice. And well, the rest is history. I don't know of anyone who's more, I don't know anyone who could have handled it like Lane did. And she, of course, had spent time in the practice over the years, but she's a phenomenal dentist. And we're so grateful that she was the one to come in and take over. You might have more to add to that story.
Well, I think then, you know, the rest of the story is then when he returned, and probably even leading up to his return, after healing, taking some time off to heal for those 6 weeks after he came back, then we realized that, oh my goodness, there is this whole component to dentistry that we had really not been aware of, or not aware of the importance of it. And so I, you know, just coming out of dental school, I didn't know what I didn't know yet. And so we were able to go on that journey together, where we really were able to focus more on our patients, not just doing conventional dentistry, but really bringing into play how oral health affects systemic health and how what we are doing in the mouth, materials we're using, what infections are present, can really affect a patient overall.
Wow. And so part of this was your own personal health journey, particularly for you, Dr. Stuart, that you used this to heal yourself or a lot of these concepts.
Oh, absolutely. And I've been always kind of been one of those all or none type people. And so when I was exposed to the therapies that I went through in Canada, I said, well, I can never go back. Mm-hmm. And so we came back. Of course, it was something that Lane was so kind to just jump on and go, but then we had to train our staff, of course. We had to retrain a patient base that had been with us for 20 years. So, but all in all, we're so grateful. It's what we get to do today is to be a part of some amazing health journeys and some fabulous stories and recoveries. And so we're so grateful. And we're so grateful, especially to be part of this Alzheimer's summit, because both of us have very, very touching stories that we've dealt with over the years. And so anything that we could do to help elucidate what dentistry has to do with this, we want to do it.
All right. Well, then let's go for it. So as biological dentists, how do you kind of think of this mouth-brain connection, right? We say all the time, there's this gut-brain connection. And then I also will tell my patients, health starts in the gut, but the gut starts in the mouth. So when you put those pieces together, where do you start?
So I think it's really the same concept of everything that's in the oral cavity affecting the gut is the same with the brain, not only just when you think about the proximity of the mouth and everything that's in it to the brain, and then it being the gateway to the gut, then that is where we really have to relook at how we look at simple cavities, infections, periodontal disease, things like that. You have to make sure you're looking at that in how it's going to be related to the brain or the gut.
You know, just one of the classic, I would say, issues both with the oral microbiome and gut microbiome is the presence of, many times for our patients still, is the presence of mercury. So it's a tremendous gut disruptor, but it's also a real disruptor in the microbiome. And of course, if you have, for example, mercury fillings in your teeth, those are off gassing 24/7, whether you want it or not, and you absorb 80% of that gas. And in itself, mercury gas is honestly not the worst of all its forms, but it very easily crosses the blood-brain barrier. And now you get a conversion into a very, very toxic form of mercury when it becomes H+2, and which then displaces other beneficial minerals in the brain, the mitochondria. And now we've got a whole new beast, and it's not just something that's breaking teeth because we have a poor filling material in the teeth. It's now we have a systemic health issue. So that's just one of many connections. It's one that most people are aware of now, that mercury filling can certainly have an impact on our systemic health, but we know that it can have a tremendous impact on brain health. I'll just go on to say, and this is so well documented in the literature, even in visual ways, where just little tiny micromolars of mercury are put onto a slide with brain homogenate, and you literally watch the brain just disintegrate in response to it. And these are micro amounts of mercury. So I just think it's something that not only does the word need to be out there about it, but we need to take it very seriously.
Is there anybody that you would not recommend having amalgams removed for?
There's no one.
No one,
right? And that's a great question. Look, and it's a question we get. Who would you not recommend? Well, I would recommend it for someone who doesn't want to take toxicity seriously.
Right.
But you know, if you want to leave, you know, the most potent neurotoxin on the planet outside of plutonium in your brain or in your body, then you maybe don't want to deal with it. But that's living in a state of denial.
So some people will share with me, their concern is that you're going to get more exposure when you put them in or take them out, that's when the exposure is highest. So what is your response to that concern?
Yeah, well, that's absolutely true. And we have a lot of patients that tell us that they ask their conventional dentists or longtime dentists who they really have a lot of confidence in, they ask them to remove their mercury fillings, and they could tell them that same thing. You'll get a huge exposure if we just fill this out. And that's very true, which is why we need protocols in place that allow us to safely remove those. And there are now, with the IAOMT, the International Academy of Oral Medicine Toxicology, they have an actual protocol that dentists can be trained in and certified in, so that there's something consistent for patients to look for in how not only does the dentist protect them, but also how they protect their staff and themselves and the environment. So there are definite There's truth to the statement as far as removing them, but that would be in an unsafe manner. We can really protect the patient when we do it properly.
That's great. And so since you brought up IAOMT, I want to make sure that everyone listening knows where to find a dentist that can take amalgams out safely. So you guys are members of IAOMT. And first, tell everyone where you are if they want to become your patient. And then if they're not close enough to come in to see you, how do they find someone like you?
Yeah, so we are in a pretty small town west of Austin. We love not being in a big city. It's kind of surprising to some of our patients that come in from really large metroplexes that there's not a lot of Ubers out here. So we're in a small town called Marble Falls, Texas. And our website is healthysmilesforlife.com, no abbreviations or anything. But if this is a little too far or you're not able to travel to see us, then the IAOMT.org website does have a place right on the homepage that just says find a dentist near me. And you can click on that link and enter your zip code. And then you can get a list of dentists that are members. But alongside each of those dentists, it'll also tell you if they're accredited, meaning beyond being a member, have they done a little more studying to be an accredited member? And then also if they're SMART certified, meaning have they gone through the training and been certified and promised to use these safety protocols when a patient comes to them for mercury removal.
The SMART acronym stands for Safe Mercury Amalgam Removal Technique. And I think it is. It's a very safe protocol, very well tested. And if you find a dentist who uses that technique, you can feel confident that you're not going to get a mercury exposure.
That's fantastic. And so what separates, other than how they remove amalgams, what separates a biological or integrative dentist from a conventional dentist outside of that?
Yeah, so that's a great question. We get that a lot as well. And there are some wonderful conventional dentists that care deeply about their patients, but they maybe haven't been exposed or aren't aware of the big connection between oral health and systemic health. And much more so, they may not realize that you really have to pay attention to as either a biological, there's a lot of different names that that we fall under, but biological or integrative dentist is looking at not only a cavity or a toothache or a patient needing a dental cleaning because of periodontal disease. We're looking at how are we going to fix this and how is it going to affect them long-term from a systemic standpoint. So that may mean we look a little differently at chronic and acute infections. It may mean that we look a little differently at material or a lot differently at materials, both that are already in the patient's mouth and that we use to maybe replace those materials or fix a tooth with. So that would be the best way to describe the difference.
I know my biological dentist, who I love and appreciate, he will do a cone beam x-ray, which is like a 3D x-ray. Do you do that as well? And do conventional dentists do that typically?
Yeah, so we absolutely do. That was a game changer years ago when we were able to incorporate that into our practice because it lets you get it's a big picture of exactly what's going on in the jaw. Before, for years, all we had was two-dimensional x-rays. And so you got a good snapshot, but you couldn't really see everything all the way around. And so it's key to being able to identify infections that are around root canal treated teeth or dead teeth. That if you look at a comparison between a two-dimensional x-ray and a cone beam x-ray, which is a three-dimensional image, the difference is huge. We don't know how many infections we may have missed in the years before having a cone beam. It also lets us look at the density of the bone in old extraction sites. And not a lot of conventional dentists have these in their offices for those purposes. They may be looking at a cone beam x-ray either in their office or from an imaging center so that they can evaluate airway or for implants or for things like that.
I see. And then tell us about root canals. Should everybody be scared of them?
Let's just jump in there.
Let's go for it.
So I'll tell you a little bit about root canals just because you all have led me into the perfect segue. And that is when we look at root canal treated teeth with a traditional two-dimensional x-ray, we miss most of the pathology associated with root canal treated teeth. In fact, I know there have been at least 17 studies now done worldwide to see how often root canal treated teeth have failed in terms of how they look on a x-ray or combing. 40% worldwide when you look at them at a through a combing or a 3D CAT scan will show us that they have a lesion or an infection associated with them. Well, if we take that one step further, and truly if we say 40% of these teeth are clinically bad, and then we look at the literature from 2019, a study done in New York, a well-known peer-reviewed study, that particular group of authors found that if you had infection on root canal treated teeth, you had a 530% increased risk of a cardiovascular event. And so what that means is, in easy terms, is that if you have a root canal done on a tooth, whether it's in this country or elsewhere, you have about a 40% chance of it failing. It may not be uncomfortable. You may not be aware of the fact that it has a chronic infection. But if you do, you're going to fall into that category where you have a very increased risk of cardiovascular disease, cerebrovascular disease, those sorts of pathogens or bacteria that are in these type of infections love to go to the brain. They love to go to the heart. That's just kind of the tip of the iceberg. They go wherever they want. So we're not fond of root canal treated teeth, basically, because the literature, in our opinion, doesn't support that in terms of a patient's overall well-being. Now, that being said, here's the problem. If we take the tooth out, we've got another problem. And so all of these are discussions that we have every day with our patients. We do not take it lightly. And I'll have to say, there is that occasion, very rarely, but there is an occasion when we would say, you know what, I think your best option here is to have a root canal done by a great holistic endodontist. Mm-hmm. But it's not that common. We wish, I personally used to love to do root canals and thought, because I didn't want to remove a tooth. And now right. I'll hardly ever recommend one because I want the patient to live robustly. Mm-hmm.
Do you have a sense? I've just been curious. I don't know the answer to this at all. But if somebody needs a root canal because of a trauma versus an infection, does that make it less likely to be associated with an infection later on?
Well, let me just step back just a moment, aside from the science, and for your listeners, when you're thinking about a root canal, whether you have one or maybe it's been recommended, and I'm going to come back to the trauma versus infection, but the whole premise behind doing a root canal is that each tooth in your mouth has 1, 2, 3, sometimes 4 roots. And that means there's a little tunnel going down the middle of each root that has the main trunk of the nerve. And if we could clean that out and fill that in, that would be wonderful. But the problem with teeth, and not the problem, but the way that they were created is that they have, if you were to cut it in half, they have thousands of these microtubules that go out from the sides of the canal. We always tell our patients here, it looks like a Texas road map. If you were to put dye in it and look at it under a microscope, that's how many miles of these microscopic tubules that are inside a single tooth. So if you clean out that main canal, you kind of cut off the nerve supply and the blood supply to the rest of that tooth. So now you have dead tissue. And we know that nowhere else in the body do we think dead tissue is compatible with health. Mm-hmm. And so we can't get around the fact that once a tooth is dead, we don't have a way to bring it back to life. So that dead tissue is just sitting in there, and that becomes the problem. So even on a tooth with trauma, even though it didn't start out with an infection, once the root canal is completed and the tooth may have been dead from the trauma, but then once the root canal is completed, it's definitely a dead tooth. And that becomes the inherent problem with root canal teeth, is they all have a certain level of bacterial infection in them.
You know, the mouth, the microbiome of the mouth is very diverse. And the bacteria are very opportunistic. They love to find a way to survive. And so when they encounter a dead tooth, they know, they're able to tell, well, this tooth has no defense. I'm going to make my way in through one of those little microscopic tunnels, and I'm going to hang out in there because nobody can get to me. Well, that's exactly right. And so you see literally what we call pleomorphism, where bacteria can change. They can go from being an anaerobic bacteria to anaerobic bacteria. They're very, very resourceful. And when they become anaerobic, they can become toxic as the devil.
So those toxins that the bacteria create, other toxins, those contribute to cognitive decline. How does that happen? Is it through the bloodstream? Is it up through the jaw? Like, how does it get there?
Well, both, because those toxins can go anywhere they wish. Biotoxins have a way to make their way through most barriers. And we now know, see, we used to not know what these toxins were that were associated with root canal treated teeth. Even 100 years ago, Weston Price was writing about this. He didn't know what the toxins were because he didn't have ways to identify them, but he knew that dead teeth were not to be messed with. And so he would even isolate the toxins away from the bacteria, introduce the toxins into the animal, and he would reproduce whatever systemic illness was in the animal, usually a rabbit, more quickly than if he injected the bacteria, because he had concentrated the toxins. Well, we know that many of these toxins now are from gram-negative bacteria, and this is what we see in the gut. When we see LPS, this lipopolysaccharide toxin, endotoxin, being released from broken-down bacteria, it's a potent, it's a potent toxin. And these can be isolated now, and there are many papers now on root canal treated teeth to demonstrate that teeth can leak just like a leaky gut. Now you'll even see in the literature, you'll see leaky teeth exposing the patient to LPS, lipopolysaccharides, the same toxins that you can isolate from those patients who have leaky gut. And so if you can believe this about root canal treated teeth, we wouldn't think about this. But those toxins now are associated not with just systemic issues like we might think of in terms of autoimmune issues, but they're also associated with not just depression, but severe depression, other neurocognitive issues. We now, and that's why it's so important, I think, that we're here today, is to talk about these neurocognitive issues, that those sorts of toxins, those are potent toxins, but then the toxins, like we talked about earlier, from heavy metals are also equally toxic.
Wow. And so, you know, if we're deciding, basically, I'm convinced from what you've told me that we should not have root canal treated teeth. What are the alternatives? Are we looking, especially in an older population, are we looking at dentures? Are we looking at implants? Are the implants any better? What do you suggest to most of your patients?
So that conversation also happens every day when we are talking about the hard conversation of taking out one tooth or three teeth, sometimes more, is how are we going to replace these? And there's a few times where it may be in an area you're removing a tooth that it doesn't require replacement. Maybe it's a very far back tooth and they've got good dentition everywhere else. Or they could do something like a partial denture if they still have quite a few remaining teeth that would maybe be removable. It would just replace the few teeth that we've removed. They also have options for bridges. Implants are an option, and sometimes there are cases where it's a good fit for a patient. We especially like it if we can use a non-metal implant, if that's the case. But probably in a patient with any type of neurocognitive decline, we would be shying away from implanting anything that isn't self in the bone. We wouldn't want to put anything, whether it be metal or ceramic, implanted into the bone on a patient that was already their immune system already dealing with everything else. You wouldn't want to add one more burden on there. But there are definitely different ways to approach replacing teeth when we take them out, and it really depends on the patient, their age, their preferences, what their goals are, that kind of thing.
When we think about Bredesen's marvelous book and his treatments. We think about, really, I don't know of a single disease that doesn't have an inflammatory component to it, but right. especially when we think about cognitive issues. And we know that an Alzheimer's brain is really has a lot of inflammation. And so we want to quell that. We want to bring that level down and at least give the patient, from an intraoral standpoint, a nice, calm environment from which to operate. So Lane's exactly right. That usually for us will not include placing something that doesn't have the patient's own DNA back into the body. We're not going to put in, I don't care what kind of implant you put into a patient. If you embed something into the bone, you're going to have some sort of a response, some sort of an immune response. But we don't want that.
Got it.
That's how we make the decision.
These are hard decisions because having a full set of teeth is a sign of health, right? And when you start taking them out, it's a scary process. So let's switch gears to how to take care of our teeth so that we don't end up in that situation. But we're going to start with the controversy. Tell me everything you know about fluoride.
Don't use it. I'm sure many of our listeners
are going to be pretty well educated and maybe even already avoiding fluoride. But when we go to pick out a toothpaste, certainly for me, like there's the crystalline, like I use the Risewell toothpaste, and then apparently there's some nanoparticles. Like it just gets so confusing. Like what toothpaste do I use?
Avoid fluoride. That's all I would say. Okay. You know, if you want to lower your IQ, you do fluoride. If that's the way, you know. So avoid fluoride. It competes for the other halogens, and every cell in our body has iodine in it. We always think of it primarily associated with thyroid health, but no. And fluoride will outcompete the cell. It'll outcompete iodine every time. So we want to avoid fluoride exposure. And we know there is actually a very slight benefit to applying topical fluoride to a tooth. But in my opinion, our systemic health way outweighs the benefit of that. And we also know this, contrary to what we hear, we also know that applying fluoride systemically, like through a public water supply, and then hoping that that's going to improve your oral health, is absolutely false. So don't use fluoride.
Okay.
And I'll answer your question on toothpaste, though.
Okay. Hydroxyapatite.
Hydroxyapatite is definitely there's definitely toothpaste that have that in there. But when patients ask me what type of toothpaste could I use, there are so many good natural toothpaste on the market now. I mean, gosh, in the last 5 years, there are many that have come on the market that when we look at those, they seem to be good. I always tell patients, you know, if you find one that you like, what you're looking for is the least amount of ingredients, just like in nutrition. The fewer ingredients, the better, and probably the most simple toothpaste. So if people ask what I use, is the most simple toothpaste you can use is baking soda and peroxide. And so that, if you want to get down all the way to the easiest thing, that's what I use every morning, take a little bit with me when I travel. You can, if you like a paste, you don't like to dip back and forth, you can mix it with coconut oil. Some patients add essential oils, that kind of thing, but the fewer ingredients, the better. So.
And does it need to like foam up, or is that doesn't do anything, right?
We don't want a foaming action because that's typically produced by sodium lauryl sulfate. And that too, there's not a greater allergen to us intraorally than sodium lauryl sulfate. So no fluoride, no SLS, and you're going to have a pretty good toothpaste.
So tell me about mouthwash. Have you heard this thing that if you use astringent mouthwashes or the ones that kill all the bacteria in your mouth, that it actually increases cardiovascular risk, right? Are you familiar with this? So do you recommend mouthwash, or you just stay away from certain types of mouthwash? What do we do around mouthwash?
Well, it does increase our risk of cardiovascular event because it will increase our pressure. There are certain bacteria in the mouth that are absolutely necessary to convert sodium nitrite and nitrate to nitric oxide, which helps dilate our vessels. And so, and when we take especially a commercial type of mouth rinse that's high in alcohol, we basically nuke the microbiome of the mouth. We don't want to nuke the microbiome any more than we want to take a broad spectrum antibiotic and nuke the microbiome of the gut. We're trying to protect this. And actually, some of the bacteria that we used to think of as bad actors in the mouth, just like in the gut, probably keep the rest of our bacteria more diligent. And so I think it's very important not to hit it with a full strength mouth rinse.
There are some friendly mouthwashes that you can use, but the main role they're playing is just kind of to freshen the mouth, to just kind of moisten everything, but they're not really playing a big role in actually increasing oral health.
Okay. So if you had to tell a patient to have the best hygiene, the best oral hygiene possible, what would a 24-hour oral hygiene plan look like?
So one of the things that we have as the biggest take home for our patients is when they come into our office and they're being evaluated in our hygiene department or they're having a new patient exam with us, one of the things we're going to check is their bacteria, the presence of bacteria. We're not depending on what the mouth looks like so much. We want to see what's actually going on under the gum line. So we're able to take a small sample of the plaque or right along the gum line and then place it on a slide and look at it under a phase contrast microscope and then show the patient on a computer screen exactly what is going on in their mouth as it relates to bacterial activity. So we're looking at, you know, we should never see a blank slide. We don't want a sterile slide, but we are looking at the amount of bacteria that's moving on that slide. And we're looking for types of bacteria that would be markers for periodontal disease. And that real time, I can have a patient says, oh no, I have nothing wrong in my mouth, no bleeding, my gums don't hurt, anything like that. And they have got a really active slide that shows that they are definitely in an acute stage of periodontal disease that we need to deal with. So one of the most effective ways to deal with that, not only just being in our office and having our very talented hygienists very effectively clean the teeth above and below the gum line and irrigate and use ozone, but at home, their biggest thing that they can do at home is to incorporate a water pick into their home care. Even more important than a Sonicare toothbrush or whatever type of toothbrush you're using is to use a water pick. And it doesn't have to be the water pick brand. That's a great brand. It can be another different brand that maybe I just always want them to have the adjustable power switch on there so that it's not just a full stream. You need to be able to adjust that for your comfort level. But the effectiveness of that comes from the fact that it's going, flushing out under the gum line. We're flushing out those bacteria so much more effectively than floss can do. And it's getting down there where your toothbrush is not able to get as well. And so many times we will tell a patient to use, they can use just plain water, but very effectively using a dilute solution of hydrogen peroxide and water or apple cider vinegar and water. And that's where we see the biggest changes for patients that they have control over at home. And it's not a very expensive type of therapy.
And what we're looking at, you know, Heather, when we're looking at that, we will see the bacteria that are associated with cognitive decline. We'll see the spirochetes that are very, very well known in that world. They're called Treponema pedicola, and they're certainly well written about in the literature. And then another one is one called P. gingivalis. We see them both. And so we can coach the patient right away, say, and it's such a motivator for the patient to look at that slide and say, oh my gosh, I didn't know my brain was at risk. My mother died of Alzheimer's, for Pete's sake. And this is a way to really help contribute to a patient's health.
So would you say like brush twice a day, floss once a day, plus water pick? And then also I want your recipe for the apple cider vinegar or the hydrogen peroxide. How much per how much water? Like when you see a dilute solution, what does that look like?
So I definitely think brushing at least twice a day is great. And that kind of depends on a patient's risk factor as far as do they have a good saliva production, then brushing twice a day might be sufficient. I have other patients who we may tell them, hey, in the middle of the day, if you can't brush your teeth, you at least need to do a really good rinse with water. But brushing would be more effective, but at least twice a day would be normal for a patient. And then if you can floss daily and you know, water pick daily, that's great. But if I have to pick one over the other and the patient says, I'll only do one of these, then I'm going to pick water pick every time because it's so much more effective. So if you can do water pick once a day, that's great as well.
And the recipe would be an ounce of either the apple cider vinegar or hydrogen peroxide. And we're just talking about 3%, that old brown bottle, garden variety hydrogen peroxide, just an ounce of that and 7 or 8 ounces of water in the water bath. And that's plenty to do the job.
And then we don't have to worry about killing too much bacteria with that, right? With the hydrogen peroxide, because that's pretty potent antimicrobial stuff.
Yeah, but it's diluted to the point where we're going to really get rid of, we'll get rid of even very stubborn anaerobes like treponema, which is we just don't like that bacteria at all. It's a spirochete that burrows into the tissues and it loves brain tissue. And so we want to get rid of that. But that dilution of about one part hydrogen peroxide to 7 or 8 water over a period of weeks, we'll get rid of it. We like to boost that up a little bit. We'll have our hygienists insufflate a little ozone under the gum tissue when they're having their teeth cleaned, and you can really have an impact on those quickly then without disturbing the good bacteria too.
Wow. And do you have any thoughts about oil pulling, using coconut oil and swishing it?
So we have a lot of patients that do that as well. And just as an overall way to detoxify, it can be very helpful. It doesn't seem to have too much of an effect like the water pick would be. I definitely wouldn't recommend oil pulling over the water pick, but it's beneficial, but maybe not as much as other ways that you can take care of the mouth.
Got it. Okay. Super helpful. So for some of our listeners, they are struggling with pretty severe cognitive decline, or someone they're caring for is. Do you have any tips for supporting somebody who has relatively severe dementia to get good dental hygiene in? And in addition to going to the dentist, it can be so stressful for a lot of people. So any suggestions for how to make that a more easy process for people?
Oh, that's such a good question. I remember when years ago, my mother pulled up at a red light in our little country town, and it turned to green, and she couldn't make the decision at age 58 of whether to move forward or not. And after 3 changes of the light, she finally made it home. But at age 58, she was diagnosed with Alzheimer's, and certainly had the symptoms long before. Our family all recognized it and had this long family history of cognitive issues. And I knew nothing about a connection between dentistry, about nutrition, about anything, and cognitive decline back then, much less Alzheimer's. And so today what we do, because so many of our patients have systemic and cognitive health issues, we encourage those patients to get all of those toxicities removed at one setting. We just lightly sedate. Usually Alzheimer's patients sedate beautifully. We sedate them lightly and remove whatever toxicities, trying to give the body at least a reprieve from those toxicities. And then we know that just like one therapy does not fit all, one therapy does not take care of Alzheimer's like one pill doesn't. This disease has many facets. And so we need those patients to be under the care of a physician who understands the many facets of cognitive decline. And so that they can be coached nutritionally, they can be coached from an anti-inflammatory standpoint, they can be coached from a detox standpoint, they can, you know, as you know, a hormonal standpoint, the list goes on and on, as we know. So that's how we encourage patients peers. We think we can do a good part on this, but this is only one part of the puzzle.
But that's really great advice to maybe think about, you know, if you're a care partner supporting someone with pretty severe Alzheimer's, if there's dental work that needs to be done, instead of just foregoing it and not doing it, maybe bundling it, doing all of it together. And it's sort of this necessary evil of doing a little bit of anesthesia. Is it like a conscious sedation sort of thing? Yeah. And then doing as much of it together all in one day and just getting it over with. And I know I work with my biological dentist and some of the other dentists in the area will give patients IVs before and after and give them some extra glutathione and things like that so that they can get up and over any of the cognitive impacts caused by anesthesia. And that can help them also to heal from any surgeries that are potentially being done in the mouth and detoxify more quickly if there is some exposure to mercury or anything else.
That's right. And you mentioned, you know, the anesthesia risk is something to consider. When we do IV conscious sedation, the depth of the anesthesia is not near what it is under a general anesthesia. But there's still, you know, there are classes of drugs that are going to have to be detoxified. And many times those mechanisms are not robust in these patients. And that's why we team up with physicians who can help quarterback that for us so that it has the least amount of impact possible.
Thank you so much for sharing your insights there. Do you have any other takeaway suggestions for listeners that they can implement right away?
Well, I think we've mentioned the water pick as being one of our top takeaways as far as periodontal disease goes. And just on a quick note for that, with caregivers of someone with advanced cognitive decline, Alzheimer's, anything like that, that can be very challenging to maintain good dental health. So I would want to be encouraging, first of all, that we all realize that that is a very challenging part of being a caregiver. But my hygienist, we have such amazing hygienists here, and they've given me some tips in the past when I've had this question from specific patients, maybe at different conferences we've been at. And a lot of it comes from just finding what works, but even using a water pick on the lowest setting, sometimes there are many times you can find a portable water pick and the patient may sit in the shower or the bath and it doesn't bother them as much. Using if a toothbrush doesn't work, using a washcloth on your finger, things like that. Mm-hmm. Just getting those surfaces clean, even if it does take a little longer, and I know it can be challenging, but I just wanted to give that little bit of encouragement that there are some ways that can be done with only a little bit of water and fluid there.
A bit creative.
Yeah, that's right. So I think water pick is one you had mentioned. And we mentioned going on the IAOMT website to find someone in your area that would be more biologically integratively minded as far as a dentist goes. And then you had mentioned another good one was interviewing your dentist and not being afraid to ask questions. I think that's a big thing of part of when patients come here, we sit and listen a lot to everything they have going on in their health and not just their mouth. And then that helps us understand a little bit more on what the impact that they have going on in their oral cavity has on their systemic health.
I think interviewing your healthcare providers is a good idea. And because you may go to an IOMT member who doesn't take seriously the tenants of that organization. Maybe he or she just wants to have a name on a website. So I would do what you recommended. I'd go to one who's accredited, one who's SMART certified, and I would sit down with them and say, well, what kind of precautions are you taking for yourself and your staff?
Oh, that's a great indication of how seriously they take it.
If they're suiting up like a spaceman, and then you have a sense that they're going to take care of you.
Right. Got it. And then what about gum? Sorry, I have so many questions for you guys. I can just keep going. You'll have to stop me at some point. But what do you think of different gums and antimicrobial gums, especially like xylitol or the sugar alcohols come up a lot?
Well, we'd certainly be more in favor of something with xylitol than something that had aspartame in it, which is a neurotoxin, you know. And most of the chewing gums are just laced with aspartame. So yes, if a patient and in that in that patient group, the Alzheimer's group, who are more prone to decay because they don't, they're not cognizant of how well they're doing with their cleaning. Chewing gum, if they would chew it, and gum that has xylitol in it might be of some help. Mm-hmm. Anything to stimulate saliva flow and to brush over the teeth, whether it's gum or otherwise, can be helpful. So I think that's a valid point. We have to remember that sometimes Alzheimer's patients will swallow the gum. The xylitol can be really disturb their digestion. So they'll have to be watched and see how well they do with it.
It's not going to be a replacement for brushing teeth.
No. It's not, which is unfortunate. And we all know what kind of care oftentimes these patients receive when they're in some sort of a facility where usually oral health takes a very back seat.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that can happen. But if we can get creative and be encouraging, maybe make a game out of it somehow. And some people love brushing their teeth, right? It's something they're used to doing, and it feels good, and it gives them a sense of accomplishment to do it. And so just getting a little bit of help and some of those techniques and tips is really, really helpful. Thank you so much for sharing. Is there anything else that you want to leave our listeners with? I certainly want them to know how to find you guys. Would you repeat your web address?
Yes. It's healthysmilesforlife.com. Just every word written out, .com. And that's where we have a lot of videos about a lot of the things we talked about today. We have just a little short 2 and 3 minute videos. If patients want a little more information on any of that, it also lets you know how to get in touch with us if you wish to.
And maybe share with your friends and family. I think this is one of the places where it comes up, where there's siblings kind of arguing over whether or not it makes sense for mom to have her amalgams removed. Yeah. And seeing videos from really credible, great dentists like you guys is so helpful for spreading that word and helping people find like faith that it's going to be, you know, the right decision to make, or even getting rid of those root canals. These are big decisions. So thank
you. We'd
love
to be a part of that, you know, a team, an integrated team that can really bring hope to these patients. And I think, for example, if I had only had Dale Bredesen's book 30 years ago when my mother was in the throes of Alzheimer's, I would have had absolute hope that we could make a real change for her. And so we want to do that. We want to be on teams that bring hope to our patients and to their caregivers.
And not just hope, but results. We get that too. It's so exciting and so fun. Yeah.
Yes, absolutely.
Well, thank you both so much for joining me. It's been a pleasure getting to know you a bit and learning. I like I said, I just have so many questions and I learn so much, and it's really helpful for me because I will now be able to take this to my patients and our Marama residents and my family. So thank you for sharing your wisdom and experience with us today. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Well, thanks for having us.
Thank you so much.